You're tuned to Live and Local, your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. This week, I'll be sharing with you highlights from previous shows over the last 2 years, mostly featuring live performances in our studio. Today, however, is a rebroadcast of a rather special interview with Anton Armstrong, conductor of the famed St. Olaf Choir, based at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Professor Armstrong became the fourth conductor of the St. Olaf Choir in 1990 after 10 years at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He is himself a graduate of St. Olaf College, and he earned advanced degrees at the University of Illinois and Michigan State University. I spoke with him on February 6, 2012, in advance of the St. Olaf Choir's 100th anniversary concert at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. We begin with the choir's performance of Alexander Gretchaninoff's setting of Our Father under the direction of Anton Armstrong.
Thank you.
We just heard the St. Olaf Choir on the direction of Anton Armstrong in a setting of the Our Father by Alexander Gretchaninov, who is a Russian composer born 1864. And Anton Armstrong is my guest on this portion of Live and Local. Thanks very much for joining us.
Kevin, this is a pleasure to be with you.
So you're coming to the University of Illinois, where you have something of a history, as did at least one of your predecessors, and it's the one thing that you and I can say we have in common, because we both have master's degrees in choral music at the University of Illinois. So
yes.
Welcome back.
Well, thanks very much. Yes, I spent two very fine years. Now it seems eons ago, from 1978 to 1980, and had the wonderful experience of being under the tutelage of Harold Decker, who was the legendary, really the one who developed the advanced degree in choral conducting at the U of I, and also spent 2 years as director of music at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church over in Urbana. So I still have some ties to that community and certainly wonderful memories, and developed some wonderful friendships that have been lifelong in their making, and especially with Andre Thomas, who was also a graduate student at the same time. We've remained very close professional and personal friends.
So the piece that we just heard of Alexander Gretchaninov, when your assistant sent it to me, it didn't have a label on it, and I said, oh, it sounds like Rachmaninoff. I thought maybe it was one of the ones from the Vespers. I couldn't quite remember. Gretchaninov, Rachmaninoff, contemporaries, weren't they?
Yes, and part of the history of that is that that piece has actually been in the performing legacy of the St. Olaf Choir back since the days of our founder, Efmelius Christiansen. And part of that is that Efmelius Christiansen was a Norwegian immigrant who came to this country when he was 18 years old, but very heavily influenced by certainly the music of Scandinavia, his native Norway. But he also spent time as a young man studying in Leipzig, Germany, so he knew the music of that region, especially the Bach motets, which have also found a way onto their repertoire, and certainly we will be singing one of, to me, the queen of the motets, Singet dem Herrn, on this tour. But the Russian choral school was also a very influential one for him in his programming. And so as we looked at this centennial tour, I wanted to go back and feature some of the works that have been known throughout the history of the choir, but also look to the future, and I think we've done a nice balance of both in this program.
You, I read, actually did your thesis at one point, when your doctoral monograph on the history of the St. Olaf Choir, so you're uniquely qualified to actually talk about all of this.
Well, yes,
business.
I did that at the time, 25 years ago, when the choir was celebrating its 75th anniversary, and I especially wanted to capture the evolution of the choir under my predecessor, Kenneth Jennings, who, for the little bit of trivia that you may want for U of I folks and folks in your listening audience, was the person for whom the graduate degree in choral conducting at the U of I was started. Dr. Jennings actually came there in the late 50s, around 1956 actually, to do a degree in musicology. And after the first year, he decided this is not really what I want, talked to one of the administrators, Scott Goldthwait, and the only advanced degree in conducting at that time was at University of Southern California. So they put their heads together and actually developed a program. They brought the composer Jean Berger in for 1 year to head the program, but while he was very gifted as a composer in his own right, maybe administration wasn't his strongest point, and that's when they found Harold Decker and brought him there in 1957. And there have been a long line of us, certainly not only from St. Olaf College, but out of the Lutheran mafia, as I call it sometimes, the Lutheran choral tradition, Rene Clausen, Paul Brandvik, others who have come through that program. And so U of I has had a very close connection with St. Olaf and with choral music throughout the country.
Since you brought it up, tell me a little bit about the Lutheran Mafia, because the St. Olaf Choir, of course, at St. Olaf College, which is an affiliate of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
That's correct.
And Augsburg is another?
Yes, as I said, at one point, about 2 years ago, there were U of I grads at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Craig Arnold, who did his master's work there, and Rene Clausen, who is now has just completed 25 years at Concordia College, our sister college in Moorhead. you know, I've been here, and one of my other predecessors and one of my mentors and longtime colleagues, Robert Schultz, who taught choral music and voice and conducting here at Zinnola for 37 years, is a product of U of I. It's one of the reasons I ended up going there, because two of my mentors, direct mentors, had come out of that program. And we have a musicologist on our faculty, our music librarian, one of the two of our string instructors are U of I grads. So there's a little fighting Illini component in the Zinnola faculty, in the Zinnola music faculty especially. But we've had this tie, and for years, U of I really was one of the beacon lights of training in this country, and because of many of the people they've sent out, Andre Thomas, for instance, Florida State, a place that has risen to the top, but it was because of the training that we received at the University of Illinois.
What is there something about the Lutheran tradition that has made so many of these small Lutheran liberal arts colleges have strong choral programs?
Well, I do think the influence of the church is a big thing, where there's still communal singing in terms of hymn singing. But even that is under siege at times with some of the more contemporary practices in worship and church music. But I think that has been a long tie, and especially so many of these Lutheran schools that I refer to come out of a Scandinavian and Germanic Northern European singing tradition that is still very much alive in these schools. And so I think we sometimes are fighting, we're a little bit countercultural. Right now we seem to be hip because of shows like Glee and The Voice, but we have continued, as I said, in this place, 100 years of choral singing at the highest level of excellence. But I think it is that tie to communities and to a church that's still where the people song, hymn singing, is very important, and still great choral music is appreciated and nurtured.
Tell me a little bit about St. Olaf College itself.
Well, St. Olaf College was founded in 1874 by Norwegian immigrants, and I think one thing that is unique, was very unique for its time, was that it was founded as a coeducational institution. Most of the Lutheran institutions that we know today were founded initially as Bible schools or theological training schools to send out young men into the ministry and education. But these Norwegian immigrants who founded this college wanted both their men and their young men and their young women to be educated, to be able to embrace the life in the new world. And music has always been an important part. Actually, the St. Olaf Band is actually older than the St. Olaf Choir. They were founded in 1891. But it was because of, I think, again, the ties to the church and a place where they wanted rigorous education, that in 1903 they called this Norwegian immigrant, Ethmelis Christiansen, here to really formally develop a music program to take the helm of the band and the choral union, as it was then called, kind of a large choral organization. And several years later, as he was developing, trying to refine choral singing, and trying to actually uphold a higher standard for church music than they had at the time. If you read some of his writings, you would think you were talking about 2012, not 1912. But he started putting together song services, almost a precursor to the modern-day hymn festivals, in which the choir was singing many of his arrangements of the great chorales. He felt that the young young people were losing their appreciation and their knowledge of the great hymns of their forebears, and he wanted to keep them alive. And so he created these incredible choral forms, took them out on the road, and when he decided to do his first program really out of town, he was also director of music at the large Lutheran church, and he discovered really that he had more people out of the St. Olaf community's faculty and students in that church choir, and actually many, many more students. And so when they did their first trip in the spring of 1912, he changed the name of the choir from the St. John's Lutheran Church Choir, and it began the birth of the St. Olaf Choir, and that's what we're recognizing this year.
And then his son took over many years later.
Yeah, well, he was at the helm of the choir from its inception in 1912, and then he had several sons. One, his eldest son, Jake, went to Concordia College and was head of athletics and football coach, and actually the stadium up at Concordia College is named Chris Johnson Stadium. But the next son in line, Olaf Chris Johnson, came here to succeed his father in 1941, and then there was a younger brother, Paul, J. Chris Johnson, who was for 50 years the choir director at Concordia and Moorhead. So there was a little dynasty both at this school and in Moorhead, Minnesota. The Chris Johnsons were all active arrangers and composers, and Olaf had come to us from Oberlin College. He had been the director of choral activities and founded the Oberlin Acapella Choir in 1929. And in those days, you got called to these positions. You didn't go through national searches, I guess. And so he shared the choir with his dad for 2 years, which were, I guess, interesting. I hear these stories still from people who are living now in their late 80s or early 90s, who sang in the choir during that those changeover years. It was very interesting. You know, there were those people who were they had their allegiance to F. Melius, and some who came with Olaf, and as Olaf is trying to bring new ways and new repertoire. But he was at the helm of the choir until 1968, and then my predecessor, Kenneth Jennings, had sung in the same old choir under Olaf Chris Johnson in the post-World War II years. And Dr. Jennings, as I said, had gone on to do graduate studies both at Oberlin College and then University of Illinois. And when Olaf stepped down in 1968, again, there wasn't a national search done. He had proven his abilities to take the helm of the choir and was appointed in that role, and he served as conductor of the choir until his retirement in 1990, and I've been here since 1990. So in these 100 years, there have been four of us. I joke I'm still considered the new conductor sometimes, even though at the end of this year I will match my predecessor's tenure as conductor of this choir. But as he said to me, at least your hair is still kind of black. So,
well, I'm looking at pictures of the four of you, and he's got all this white hair and almost looks like he's got a halo around him.
I've said that too. Sometimes I say, when people see that picture of my three predecessors all with this striking gray hair as they had in those pictures, I feel a little bit like, you know, the Holy Trinity and I'm the fallen angel at that point, but we'll see.
I think I saw some pictures where some's creeping into yours.
Yeah, there's some coming there.
Yeah, and the mustache maybe more than...
The mustache,
more
exactly.
Than, that's, yeah. That's the giveaway.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that two of them were, your two predecessors, immediate predecessors, were essentially appointed to the posts. You had to apply. Any idea what made them change the approach this time around?
Well, I think certainly it was just the practice in 1990 of any academic appointment at a major college like St. Olaf College. No longer would there just be an instant ascension. And so there was actually an international search. The five finalists came from, actually four of us ended up being St. Olaf graduates, and then the fourth was Ann Howard Jones, who at the time was on the faculty at the U of I. She was in the choral department, and she had established herself in her own right, but she was still serving as Robert Shaw's assistant with the Atlanta Symphony Chorus and Orchestra. And Ann and I have been friends for many years, even before that point. But I felt honored to be in the company of such very revered conductors at the time. I was the baby in the group. When I got this job, I was 33, so I guess revealed my age. But it was a very strenuous audition process. We all came to campus, days and days of 5 days these poor kids had to put up with different people in front of them, and we had hours and hours of interviews with various committees and administrators. And the final thing that I got to do was actually make music with the St. Olaf Choir. And, you know, I thought, I don't know if I'll get this job. This may be the only time. And it was like driving a nice, you know, Bentley, and I drove it hard.
You know, I just had a conversation, I'm now going to forget what orchestral conductor, who was talking about the experience of driving one of the big, and he used the same analogy, driving one of the big major orchestras as compared to driving, you know, something small, something lesser, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's like, he said it was like driving a well-tuned sports car where you tweak your finger and it goes this way.
And that's what this ensemble is like. It's part of the joy in making music. You know, we are in a liberal arts college. We have a conservatory-level department of music, but we are in a liberal arts college, and about 30-35% of the members of this choir are non-music majors, and they bring a wonderful refreshment to this enterprise. And because we are in a very rigorous academic institution, where, for instance, the study of language is highly valued and highly stressed in the curriculum, these young people have a quick ear in dealing with languages and the variety of languages. I think they're singing in four or five different languages from memory. This year it's a little bit more normal, maybe Norwegian being the oddest, but you know, they've sung in Persian before, they have sung in Hebrew, they have sung in tongues of Latin America that are barely even used these days, and they have sung in Maori language, as well as the standard European languages found in the canon of great choral music. But they're bright, and they work very hard, and there's still this Midwest work ethic that just pervades this community and the young people, and they don't want to settle for mediocrity. They want to do things at the very best that they are able. And the amazing thing to me has been that while this choir is still composed of basically 19 to 22-year-olds, and no, we may not make the sound that an older professional choir can make. What we can do is to make music at a level of excellence where the finer details of nuance, the beauty of sound, the attention to phrasing and to text painting maybe comes through in a way that you might not always hear with older voices or even more professional singers. We work, I think, very much at a professional level, as you will hear when we come to the Krannert Center again. But I think I go back and quote Robert Shaw often in this way. He did not talk about the amateur when he talked about the amateur musician in a pejorative sense. He always went back to the root of that word, amo amare, to love, to be the great lovers of the art. So what we do in practice, I think, is to perform our music at the highest professional levels, but with the heart of the true amateur, the great lover of the choral art.
Since you mentioned singing in other languages, I thought we'd have one hear the St. Olaf Choir in this music by Alfred Paulsen, arranged by your predecessor Kenneth Jennings, called Norge mit Norge, which means what?
Norway, my Norway. And one reason it's in the program this year, there was a very functional reason as well as one historical. I wanted to at least pay homage to the Norwegian roots of this college and this choir. But we were very honored to have the royal family, the sitting king and queen of Norway, visit United States, and St. Olaf was one of their major points of destination. And so we sang in a very special convocation for the king and queen of Norway in October and sang this piece, which in many ways is written by a Norwegian who emigrated to America, but it is a song that reflects back on the homeland in many ways, but is known by many generations of Norwegians. And quite frankly, when we finished, the Queen of Norway just broke into applause. Now, everyone else wasn't sure should they do it or not, and it was really funny because she kind of looked and she said, and you could see her mouth, they are wonderful. And then I think, but the king was about to speak again, so he continued, and on her way out, she actually turned to the choir and blew them a kiss, and the king nodded as well. So it's a piece that captures, I think, the spirit of the people who founded this college and certainly the man who established this choir. And while we have gone in many directions in terms of our repertoire and our performance practice, even the vocal sound of the choir, we're very grateful for these roots with these sturdy immigrants who came to us from Scandinavia.
Oh.
We heard a performance by the St. Olaf Choir of Alfred Paulsen's Norge mit Norge, Norway my Norway, arranged by Kenneth Jennings and conducted by Anton Armstrong. You're listening to a rebroadcast of my conversation with Dr. Armstrong from February of 2012, when the choir performed at the Krannert Center in Urbana. You mentioned just before we played that aspects of the sound have changed over the years under the four directors, and also certain elements of the repertory. And I read also from the wonderful booklet that I think you're touring with, since you've gotten there anyway, not only the sound, but also the things they do with themselves on stage physically.
Well, we need to clarify exactly what we mean by that.
That wasn't put very well.
No,
I'll let you clarify.
That's fine. I think one of the things that that has influenced my teaching over the years is a mantra that that was espoused by a wonderful woman who has been, while I never sat in a formal classroom with her as a student, over the years I've gotten to know her, and it's Helen Kemp. Dr. Kemp is now 93 years old and for years served as professor of voice and church music at Westminster Choir College. But this mantra is body, mind, spirit, voice. It takes the whole person to sing and rejoice. And I want the young people to be able to feel the music. I don't want them to sing from the larynx up. And music, you know, from the Western European tradition that we brought over to North America, we've kind of formalized music more and more. And when I go to other parts of the world, as I've traveled to certainly to Latin America, as I've traveled tip of Africa, as I've traveled to the Middle East and to the Pacific Rim, music is so much more a part of daily life and to people, and that means people are moving. Their bodies are not just stiff and standing still. And, you know, the music of the Baroque is so much based on dance music that I want them to feel, and not we're not doing choreography and all of that, but we are allowing the body to, I think, be more released and to sing, and that reflects the joy of the music or the pathos if we're dealing with that type of mood. But I want all of them to be engaged. And even more directly, in the last 15 years, I was asked in the summer of 1998 to begin a high school program for the Oregon Bach Festival by the founding directors of that program, Roy Salzman, the administrator, and then the eminent Helmut Rilling from Germany. And part of that, what we offer to high school young people from around the nation, is an intensive two-week experience. But part of that is, in addition to choral rehearsals and vocal techniques and musicianship classes, they also take a class called body singing, which is the first view of a music educator, it's kind of a glorified doll crows. Well, it goes far beyond doll crows. The colleague, Dr. Therese Hibbert, who teaches this course, is a singer herself, a dancer, a conductor, and she tries to bring the element of the young people feeling all aspects of the music in their bodies. And if they can feel it in their bodies, then they even have a greater ability to transmit it vocally. And so I want them to feel that they can move, and not moving to be a distraction, though I guess if they move a little iota, if somebody who's used to seeing stiff, wooden people on risers sing, will think that it's a distraction. I think most people, especially younger generations, appreciated the fact that while this group is very highly synchronized in its singing, if I can use that term, that they feel the music, and it's not just a cerebral experience, it's a holistic experience. And so, we freed up the body a bit more.
Vocally, where does the tradition, what's been the development of the tradition? I read that early on there was relatively vibrato-less singing, very, very, very tight sound.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say so much tight, but certainly compared to much of the vocal singing that sometimes is practiced in this country, there was a great deal of discipline. F. Manus Chris Johnson was actually an instrumentalist by training, a superb violinist and organist. He also studied the clarinet as a boy. But like any good string player, you have a disciplined use of vibrato. And he brought that sound ideal as well from Northern Europe, which is not this sort of excessive flutter tremolo that sometimes we hear, especially in this country, by singers today who think that's freedom. Well, that usually is hyper-functioning of the instrument, to be quite frank. But I think it's certainly in the last 42 years, since Jennings assumed the helm and then as I followed him, there I would say that the sound of the Chris Johnsons, I call a bit more of a sound of conformity. They found kind of an ideal sound, and everybody had to match into that ideal sound per section. And Jennings taught voice himself. I have a degree in vocal performance. So the two of us have come from a bit more in terms of we want healthy singing. Ken Jennings always remarked that when he took the choir over in 1968, he tried to uncork the vibrato bottle, and then he spent the next 21 years trying to putting back on again. And I haven't tried to squish that. What I have tried to do is that the types of singers that we attract as an undergraduate school without a graduate program tend to be younger voices and more leader, art song type of voices. You know, one of the great joys of being at the University of Illinois when I was a student there was, you know, the eminent John Wussman was there, and he and Eric Dahlheim, I think, in their coaching approach with the fine voice faculty at the time, people like James Bailey and Grace Wilson, William Warfield, while they certainly produced wonderful opera singers like the late Jerry Hadley and others who have gone on, Nathan Gunn, who's there now, there was always this sense of we don't want to just produce singers who can just sing big and loud. A lot of schools do that, a lot of conservatories. It was always about the beauty of the singing. And that very much is the core of what we do here. So we are a leader element of school. And so the influence, the union between text and music is very important to us. And with these younger voices, we do this, as you will see when we come and hear us when we come to Urbana, you know, we have a small chamber orchestra that we're using. So I like the colors that instruments bring, the ability to do an older style of music like the Bach Motet in a more historical, accurate performance practice as we understand it now, but also to do, as we are doing in this program, new music that has been created for the ensemble and for instruments. And we're doing that with a premiere of a piece called On Horizons Brim by a Minnesota composer, Ralph Johnson. It gives us a wider palette to play with, and while we may be beginning with a wonderful Palestrina motet, Sicut Cervus, it needs to sound very different than the spiritual that comes near the end of the program by Moses Hogan. They cannot sound the same. And so we try to explore different colors of the voice. I will still say, you know, people, what you still hear is a very, rather than a sound of conformity, I think you hear greater aspects of uniformity. And I'd rather think of the sound is not a hell sound. It's not straight tone. I don't want a straight tone. And quite frankly, if you really do listen to this choir, even we have historical recordings, it was never straight. It was just highly disciplined, so you didn't get flutter left and right. But I think what Jennings and I had tried to do in these last 42 years is to release the sound more, but ask that there's a center to any release vibrato, and that vibrato is also used as a coloring technique. There may be less of it in a work like Sicut Cervus, but you know, when we get to very, there's a piece by Waldemar Wöhler, a German Moravian composer, that we're doing with strings. It sounds very much like Brahms. The sound has to be more opulent. It has to be fuller, you know. And the spiritual certainly asks for that. And so I think we try to examine colors of sound, what variety we can find, and the palettes that we're painting. We're always painting pictures with our voices, and then what the score requires. Not trying to implant a sound on the score, but what does the score require? I learned that at the University of Illinois years ago with some of the leading choral musicologists there and wonderful musicologists and outside of the choral area. And so that as we go forth, the sound has to change, but it has to be, I think, natural for 19 to 22-year-olds. So they don't need to sound like they're 40 or 50-year-old singers. And I think we achieve a happy balance in that sense.
I'm talking with Anton Armstrong, who is a conductor of the St. Olaf Choir at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. They're coming to the Krannert Center on Thursday evening as part of their 100th anniversary tour. Let's hear this piece that is going to be in part three of your program by Peter Hamlin. This is Before I Go My Way, and this has a very different sound than either of the pieces we've heard so far. Talk about this piece a little bit.
Well, this was a piece that was commissioned for the choir in 1997. Peter Hamlin was then serving in our faculty. He stayed with us for about 12 years, and then his alma mater, Middlebury College, called him back to be head of the department to follow his mentor. And so we lost Peter. Very few people ever leave this place when they get tenured, but he did. And I wanted a piece not only for chorus, but often I have a wonderful faculty colleague, Charles Gray, who has served as concertmaster for the chamber ensembles when I bring a small orchestra on tour. But he's an incredible violinist and violist. And this is for viola. I love the rich sound of the viola with the human voice. So this is scored for choir and Debussy, viola. It's set to psalm text drawn from Psalms 39 and 90. He actually wrote it in response, and Peter is a wonderful composer with a wide dimension to his writing style. But we had suffered in 1997 a very tragic loss of a young faculty member who had joined the faculty with him several years earlier, and she taught in the Norwegian department. And this death really impacted his life. And so this turned out to be his homage to Leslie and Grove. And you hear this, and in many ways, the choir and is almost a response to the viola. And sometimes I wonder if that's not Leslie's voice in many ways. But going back to the comfort and the security of Psalm 90, O Lord, you have been our refuge from one generation to another. And I also thought, as I was looking at 100 years, this is also a strong testimony to the work of this choir and the steadfastness in its message and in its mission over 100 years.
Before I Go My Way by Peter Hamlin, sung by the St. Olaf Choir, led by Anton Armstrong, here on Live and Local.
You are here.
The St. Olaf Choir, under the direction of Anton Armstrong, sang Before I Go My Way by Peter Hamlin. Anton Armstrong is my guest in this rebroadcast of a live and local program from February 2012. I'm Kevin Kelly. I read that, and you talked a little bit about this, that not only the changing of the sound with yourself and especially with Kenneth Jennings as well, but also the changing and broadening of some of the repertory that the choir sings. You've talked about your own travels and the choir's travels and learning different languages and so on. What's been your approach to selecting music for the choir?
Well, first of all, what will be appropriate for these young people to sing? And knowing that we have to be out on tour for doing this tour is, I think, 16 concerts in 17 days, something that will wear well with young voices, but will also be interesting to them to prepare over a period of time and to share with a variety of audiences in a variety of acoustical venues. There's a lot that goes into thinking. So into my thinking is I'm preparing a tour program. It's harder to do, you know, an audience. We were in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, at the very beginning of this tour. Small little town, northern Minnesota. I have to be able to appeal to them, yet I'm coming to great centers of choral music like the University of Illinois, like Michigan State University, the Strathmore Center in Washington, D.C., downtown Chicago. Very sophisticated audiences. And so I try to look at a smorgasbord of choral literature that will all of it of quality, but things that will span, a breadth of chronological era, of styles. Our college is one that is rooted in a very rigorous liberal arts education. We are a community of faith, so that still the majority of music that we sing is of religious nature. And we are also have a very strong commitment to preparing young people in the 21st century in a global context. We still send the largest number of young people of any undergraduate institution to study abroad. And so part of this challenge every year is to find a repertoire that will be interesting, that will live well over, you know, a 2.5-week period, and that will be engaging with the audience. People come to our concerts for a myriad of reasons. Some come because they are people of faith and they know they may be Lutherans, or they are, you know, they come because they know the historical lineage of this college as a college of the church. Some come because they know of the history and maintaining this standard of excellence in choral singing, so they come for the aesthetic reason. Others come maybe because they think, so this is the Golden Girl Choir? You know, I get everything. But, you know, when they come, I'm not trying to be didactic. My predecessor, Olaf Fritz Johnson, was once asked, you know, do you go out to convert? No. It didn't happen then, and it doesn't happen now. But do we try to share a message of faith? Yes. And I think I have young people in the choir who are Protestants, who are Roman Catholics, who are Jewish, who are, last 2 years I had a young man who was Baha'i. I have people who would consider themselves from no faith tradition. And they have to find their way into this music. What I hope the music will be, what I hope this concert experience will be, is that it will supersede mere entertainment. I'm gratified when people find they're moved aesthetically by the singing of the choir, and that hopefully we have done our homework well and that we are interpreting the music with correct musicological and historical performance practices, and that we have the basic elements of good ensemble singing, good tuning, attention dynamics, text painting, all of those things. But for me, it's when it goes beyond that realm, and that the music becomes a transformational experience for both the performance and the listeners. And if they leave that performance a bit more in tune with who they are as human beings, and maybe a bit more sensitive to the world around them, their loved ones and their families, those with whom they work, those with whom they live, and maybe to think in a world that so often talks about division these days, and we've seen whether it's in our politics or even in the world of faith, where we seem to be so quick to find that which divides us rather than that which unifies us. I think in the choral art we can find great unity. You know, I talked before about the different colors of sound, and the way I think of that is as a mosaic, as a tapestry in which these young people bring their voices, and rather than making them sound like each other, we find just by seating in other ways, placement in the choir, we find that they can be individuals within this incredible tapestry of sound, this incredible mosaic. And that's what I've tried to do as well with the programming, is to create a mosaic, and that there are individual strands, but we put it together and there's something there for everyone. My dear late mother sang in the church choir until she was well into her 80s. And while she liked Bach and she could appreciate it, it took her a while to deal with Penderecki when I programmed Penderecki. I had to learn to talk about the piece a bit more, not just perform it. She helped me to become a better teacher. But for her, you know, our signature piece is a setting of the Crusaders and Beautiful Savior. You know, she would put up with all the rest of that stuff as long as she heard Beautiful Savior. And I want something in the program that someone can find at least one thing that they can relate to, and hopefully there'll be many more things, but that they go home fed. They are fed aesthetically, and they're fed intellectually, and they're fed emotionally.
We're going to go out now with the piece that is, in fact, the closer on the official program. It is a spiritual arranged by Moses Hogan, the late Moses Hogan. My soul's been anchored in the Lord. You are the choir's first black conductor. Does this come from your own personal experience, or have you brought spirituals in to the repertoire for some other reason?
Well, I think, yes, as an African-American, I wanted to reflect something distinctive of my own experience, my own human experience. I think each of the conductors did that in their own way. This choir was not known, you know, for doing spirituals. Certainly under the founder, he never sang a spiritual in the 30 years that he directed the choir. His son did one. In 1955, when they went to Europe, they did Harry Burleigh's Deep River. And Kenneth Jennings was better about exploring the realm of the spirituals. He did several over his 22 years. I came in, and one of the first things in the first week that I had the choir and we had to sing for a public worship service was to do one of F. Mailer's great chorale motets, O Day Full of Grace. And at the end of the service, we were singing South African freedom hymns. And I felt that there is music, and Dr. Jennings started opening that door beyond typically the Western European choral literature in his programming, certainly as near the end of his tenure, as the Eastern Bloc was dissolving, we were having more exposure to music of Eastern Europe that was happening. And in the last 4 years or so, he made two sojourns with the choir to Asia. And so they began taking on some of that. He opened the door, and I've kicked it wide open in these last 22 years. And for me, yes, I think one of our distinctive American forms is the African-American spiritual. So as I celebrate, first of all, America, I want to celebrate this very distinctive form. But as I travel throughout the world, I just got an invitation today to come and to do a lecture in Europe. And what did they want? They wanted a lecture on the Negro spiritual. I'm going to Siberia in April to be a judge, I think the only non-Russian judge, on a national choral competition. But part of the thing that they want me to do, again, is on this art form. And and whether I've been in Piteå, Sweden, or Brisbane, Australia, or Patagonia, Argentina, or in Jerusalem in Israel, when I've done this music, this music, though it was born out of the experience of these Africans put into slavery and brought to this country, and this country is built on the backs of Africans who built literally our capital buildings and the whole economic structure of this country. But their experience goes far beyond any one race, because it talks about the human experience. And so I don't do a spiritual at the end of the program just to get some sort of emotional rise. What I am, this is an incredible celebratory music, though, that talks about the human experience. And as a college of faith, we do a myriad of music styles, both sacred and secular. But in the end, this is another way of stating who we are and saying, my soul's been anchored in the Lord. And this music, I tell you, for folks who don't even think they want to have church, they'll have some church.
Anton Armstrong, he's been my guest here on Live and Local, and he leads the choir in Moses Hogan's arrangement of My Soul's Been Anchored in the Lord here on Live and Local. Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Kevin, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to returning to that wonderful great hall at the Cranford Center and to being with your community, a community that nurtured me earlier in my life.
Amen.
My Soul's Been Anchored by the Lord, an African-American spiritual, sung by the St. Olaf Choir, conducted by Anton Armstrong. Dr. Armstrong was my guest on Live and Local in February 2012, when the choir sang its 100th anniversary concert at the Kranert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. Join us again tomorrow for live performance highlights from 2012, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks for joining us.